You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The comic book genre seems to have exploded over the last two decades, and it's become routine to see superheroes in movies and television shows, and one even served recently as an honorary UN ambassador. In a new book called More Heroes of the Comics, 100 New Portraits of the Legends of Comic Books, illustrator Drew Friedman tells the stories of the writers, artists, and company founders who are pioneers in the field, and he joins us now, along with Karen Green, Columbia University's first curator for comics and cartoons. She wrote the foreword to the book, which is published by Fantagraphics Comics, and I'm pleased it has brought Drew Friedman and Karen Green to our show. Welcome.
Hi, Lenny.
Thank you.
Drew, do you see this as a logical follow-up to your previous book, Heroes of the Comics, 100 New Portraits of the Legends of Comic Books?
I think so. I hadn't planned on doing a sequel because the first book kind of covers the cream of the crop of that world, the legendary guys you would expect, like Al Jaffe, who wrote the foreword to the first book, and Siegel and Schuster and Stan Lee and Jack Kirby and Bob Kane.
Harvey Kurtzman.
And Harvey Kurtzman, of course, and William M. Gaines. So I thought I had it all covered, but then little by little, my list started to expand, and then people would ask me, like, well, why wasn't Nick Carty in the book or Gene Colan? And that list kept expanding, and I realized I had enough people for a sequel.
And in looking over the book, which is filled with your illustrations and brief bios of these people, some of them are famous, but a lot of them probably less known, we realize that they all played a major role in the development of not only comic books, but also in the relationship between comics and literature and Hollywood.
That's true. The new book features a lot of obscure creators, artists and writers and editors and publishers, and also some people who began their careers in comic books in the early 40s, like Patricia Highsmith and Mickey Spillane, who gained their greatest success a little later as novelists. But Patricia Highsmith wrote comic book stories for Timely Comics. One of the characters she wrote for was called Jap Buster Johnson, which I don't think they could get away with that today. But by the end of World War II, she moved on and wrote Strangers on a Train and a Dish of Salt, etc.
And Mickey Spillane. Now she's become a movie franchise, all the Bourne films.
Right. Well, A Dish of Salt became the recent film Carol. But she began her career in comic books, and a lot of people don't realize that. And again, a lot of the people in this new book are very obscure, but all had some kind of contribution to that world of early comic books.
Only a few of them are still alive. So how did you get the photographs of them that you have made your drawings from?
Well, that was a bit of a struggle because a lot of them, again, are very obscure. I didn't want to actually approach any of the artists themselves or creators or their families. I didn't want to bother anybody. It's my project, and you know, it was up to me. So I have a good team of friends who are able to come up with some photos. These days on the web, you know, there's a lot of stuff available, and in some cases not. So I did reach out to Abe Vigoda because both of his brothers are in the new book. His brother Bill was an artist for Archie Comics, and then he had a younger brother, Hi Vigoda, who was a writer for comic books in the early 40s. I had no idea he even existed. So I actually approached Abe Vigoda, who had become a friend because he came to some of my parties for my Jewish comedian books. But he died, so his daughter sent me a photo of his brother Bill. And then I got in touch with Hi Vigoda's granddaughter, Ashley, and she sent me a photograph of her grandfather. So I had reference to work from.
How many of the people you profile in this book did you have personal dealings with?
I've met some of them when I was a little kid. I was a big comics fan, so I'd go to some of the comic conventions. I also, my dad, who's the writer Bruce J. Friedman, had a day job as a magazine editor in the 50s and into the mid-60s. So at his office was called Magazine Management, and Magazine Management also owned Marvel Comics. So Stan Lee was in the very next office to my dad for 10 years. So, of course, when I visited my dad when I was just a little kid, 6, 7, I'd make a beeline for Marvel Comics, and Stan was the host. And he took a liking to me because he knew I liked to draw. So I met Stan, and I met Steve Ditko and Jack Kirby and a lot of the artists that passed through those offices.
Who put in your first book.
Yeah. And then later on when I went to School of Visual Arts and my teachers were Will Eisner, and Harvey Kurtzman, the great Harvey Kurtzman, who created Mad Comics, and Art Spiegelman as well. So I got to know these people that way, and little by little, became friends with some of the Mad guys as well, like Al Jaffe and Mort Drucker.
Karen, how did you get involved in this project?
Well, I've actually known Drew's work since I was fairly young. I had a subscription to Heavy Metal magazine back in the 80s, and Drew did amazing comics back then. And I always assumed, because he was doing comics about people like William Frawley and Joe Franklin, that he was, you know, old as like my father's age. And it was only when I became involved with the Society of Illustrators and I met Drew that I realized he was 1 month, 2 months older than I am.
Both born 1958.
A very good year. But the way that I got to that was I was hired at Columbia as the librarian for ancient and medieval history being my own scholarly background. But I've loved comics since I was a kid, and I realized that Columbia's libraries didn't really have a collection. And I thought it was an important art form, an increasingly important art form, as we're seeing through, winning national book awards for March, or people like Alison Bechdel and Jean Luen Yang becoming MacArthur Genius Award recipients. I thought it was important that we have representation of this art form. And it's just grown and grown, and now we have archives of people like Chris Claremont, Al Jaffe, Wendy and Richard Pini, Kitchen Sink Press, Howard Cruz. So we're trying to curate a collection of New York City history through comics history.
And the libraries have just announced a reorganization. As part of that, you'll be moving into the Rare Book and Manuscript Library at Columbia. Are these books rare?
Well,
can we think of them as an extension of ancient manuscripts?
I think that there's a long tradition of visual narrative going back to the Bayeux Tapestry, or to Hogarth's print series. And I think that comics are part of that tradition. I don't know that they're quite as valuable, although if you see a copy of Action Comics number 1 going for $2.1 million, and you see how much a medieval manuscript goes for, you might think that they're in the same ballpark.
There was a New Yorker cartoon of a caveman doing two stick drawings, and the person next to him says, well, what's the caption? There's a drawing of you in this book because you wrote the foreword. How do you like the way that Drew depicted you?
I love that portrait so much. I didn't let Drew show it to me before he actually handed me the original art. I didn't want to see it. I wanted to see it with his face and be able to react to it. And it just took my breath away. It's an unusual expression, although I did finally find the photo that he had used. And I think it captures a certain insouciance that I like to believe that I have.
I was nervous about doing it. It's like when people ask me to draw them, I said, really? You want me to draw you? Why? What are you thinking?
But you draw rather realistically, perhaps more than most people in the field. And maybe it feels comfortable to have somebody draw you in a way that is kind of like a photograph but still looks like an illustration.
I suppose it's maybe hyper-realistic, but you're going to get like a more intense portrait, I suppose, if I take you on, and more liver spots than you deserve, finally.
One of the things I love most about Drew's portraits, not so much mine, but the others, is as a medievalist, I'm used to portraits that include like an attribute that kind of, like St. Catherine depicted with her wheel or St. Lawrence with his griddle. And Drew does these amazing portraits of people with kind of the attributes of their profession, of their lives. And it's part of that long tradition of portraiture.
Have you thought about why some of these people have become so important to the world beyond their role in comic books? For example, some years ago when I had Stan Lee on the show, I can't remember who followed him, but it was a very famous person. He said, "You expect me to follow Stan Lee?" Well,
Stan Lee is one of those examples of like one of the guys in these books. He's in the first book, whose career just went beyond a normal publisher's career or a comic book editor. He just invented this entire universe that is still celebrated to this day in movies, mostly movies now, but I think they still do the comic books. My interest in that world sort of ends in the mid-50s when EC Comics ends and the Comics Code comes in. I think things get kind of sanitized, and I have less interest in mainstream comics at that point, and my interest kind of veers over towards underground comics, which came along a little later, the work of Robert Crumb and those guys. And that's the world I wanted to move into when I originally became an artist, worked for Underground Comics and then National Lampoon. And that kind of evolved into a Raw magazine, which Art Spiegelman put out in 1980, and I was in the first issue of that. So that's my career kind of began with Raw. So it was kind of like an evolution.
I'm speaking with Drew Friedman, whose latest book is called More Heroes of the Comics, 100 New Portraits of the Legends of Comic Books, and with Karen Green, who's Columbia University's first curator of comics and cartoons. We'll continue our conversation after this. And we are back with Drew Friedman, whose latest book is More Heroes of the Comics, 100 New Portraits of the Legends of Comic Books. It is published by Fantagraphics Comics. Also with us is Karen Green, Columbia University's first curator of comics and cartoons, which suggests that comic books have entered into a new realm of the public consciousness. Now, the first person, the people you cover in this book, these 100 new portraits, you've listed them alphabetically.
Mm-hmm.
The first person is Jack Alder. Can you talk a bit about him?
Jack Adler was...
Production
guy at DC National Comics for 40 years, starting in the 40s. And, you know, a talented artist, writer, et cetera. And he was the cousin of Howard Stern's mother, Ray, which I had known about for years because Howard Stern has always mentioned Jack on his show affectionately over the years. So the book kicks off with him, and the book ends with Bob Wood, who had the most notorious career post-comic books. When his career in comics ended, he was a writer for Crime Does Not Pay.
And then he proved that.
Yeah. It's like, I'm not going to go into detail about what he did, but it's the most sordid thing that's ever happened in that world of comics. It's a really sad ending. And that's how the book ends.
Now, Jack Adler, you write, briefly flirted with 3D in comic books. Wasn't 3D a fad for a time? Why was it abandoned?
Like in movies, it was a fad, and it's just like, you know, people got tired of it. It was just, they could take it so far. They did 3D, the Three Stooges were 3D, put out as 3D comics for some reason. Mighty Mouse, EC Comics put out several 3D titles. And just the fad just ended for movies, for comics, for everything.
Well, you definitely needed the glasses.
Yeah, well, it was kind of awkward, and also the effect was just never that great. It sounded better on paper, but when you actually like looked at the process, it was just kind of boring finally.
Karen, one of the few living people in this book is Jules Pfeiffer.
Mm.
And he had a relationship with Will Eisner, who's one of the great legends.
Absolutely.
Of comic books. Now,
we're actually heading into the centennial of Eisner's birth in 2017.
And Jules Pfeiffer is nearing the centennial of his own birth, isn't he?
He's about 8. I knew him also when I was a kid.
He was
pals with my dad. I think he's 87 now. But he's in the book because he actually never worked in comic books. But again, he worked as Will Eisner's assistant when he was a teenager. And then wrote this amazing book called The Great Comic Book Heroes in the mid-60s, which I loved and devoured when I was 7.
And then he had this legendary script. A strip in the Village Voice that I think probably spoke for a whole generation
of
readers.
It was originally called 666, and then they just changed it to Pfeiffer.
Now, you found a very early picture of him to base your drawing on. Anybody who knows Jules Pfeiffer is going to have a hard time recognizing him from that picture.
He has a nice head of hair in the drawing I did. It's like early 50s Jules Pfeiffer. The first book I drew people when they were older. You know, I like drawing people when they're older. But finally, I think it became too easy for me or too expected maybe. So this new book shows the majority of them when they were younger, when they were like, you know, during their careers in the 30s and 40s and 50s.
Let's talk a bit about EC Comics because two of the people you profile here, Myron Fass and Harry Harrison, were there. But EC Comics was important in the history of comic books, and I suspect that younger listeners have no idea what that was all about.
Yeah, the EC Comics, I think they were, well, they're remembered for the horror comics, but what I loved especially
and the fact that there was a congressional hearing based on EC Comics.
Yeah, it was the horror comics and the crime comics that got them shut down, but they also published Mad, that was, again, created by Harvey Kurtzman in the early 50s. And, of course, Mad, like, you know, escaped the Comics Code, became a magazine and still exists to this day and became an institution. But after 1955, Harvey Kurtzman, who to my mind is the greatest genius who ever worked in mainstream comic books, would never work for comic books again after 1955.
Well, another reason, work for Playboy.
Yeah, he switched over to magazines and Playboy and other projects. But one of the reasons I sort of lose interest in comics is because they lost Harvey Kurtzman around that time. Mm. So it was like...
Now, how are you collecting EC Comics? What does EC stand for?
It started out as
educational
comics, but that morphed into entertaining comics.
Were they ever educational?
They were.
They were published by...
Tales from the Crypt was educational.
That's when it became entertaining.
They were originally published by Bill Gaines' father, who died in a boating accident. Max Gaines. And Bill Gaines inherited the business. Bill Gaines wanted to be a high school chemistry teacher, but all of a sudden he inherited this comic book business he had no interest in. But he hired Al Feldstein, and he started looking into what they could do and changed the name from educational to entertaining comics. And they certainly were entertaining. They hired the best artists and got great scripts. And people love that stuff.
But to answer your question, we're not collecting a lot of comic books. There's a collection at Michigan State that is incredibly comprehensive on collecting comic books. We're collecting creator archives, process materials, correspondence, contracts, the sorts of things that scholars who are trying to understand the industry or the history of publishing or cultural history are likely to find useful.
One fascinating part of that cultural history is the story of Orrin C. Evans.
Right. Mm. Well, he was a newspaper, African-American newspaper journalist, and he had a desire to produce a comic book with a black audience in mind, which he did in 1947. He put out one issue called All Negro Comics out of Philadelphia, where he worked. He hired his brother and his friends, all black, to contribute, to do artwork. And the sad part is that the local news dealers would not put it on the stands. Yeah. They would not sell it. They refused. So it was only one issue. He had a second issue prepared. It never came out. And he went back into the world of newspaper editing and publishing. And that was the end of that.
Well, there was a concern about lack of diversity somewhere around the 60s or 70s, and then we started seeing a lot of African-American characters mm-hmm. in comic books.
That's true. Late 60s, especially, a character called Luke Cage came out from Marvel. But
Marvel.
Yeah, Marvel actually put that out. But the early years of comics, it was really a man's world. There were very mm-hmm. few women who worked in it. There were some. And there were in my first book, I have two black artists who were included. And this new book has one, Orrin Evans. And I also have one Cuban artist. But it was really a white man's world back then, and mostly Jewish, mostly young Jewish people. Young Jewish men got into that business in the late 30s when Superman exploded. And then they were looking for all this new talent to, imitate Superman and like that.
Because Superman was created by two Jewish
writers. Siegel and Schuster from Cleveland, who created him and then sold all their rights to Superman to the publishers at DC, Harry Donenfeld, Jack Liebowitz, for $130.
And one of those Asian heroes in the book is Ben Oda, who was a letterer. And mm-hmm. I particularly like that Drew included people who are not necessarily the first, have the kind of roles that you don't necessarily think of when you think of comics, because lettering is crucially important to telling the story, and it's not something that most people consider.
And at the front of many comics in the old days, they used to give credit to the letterer as well. We mentioned Patricia Highsmith earlier as one of the, as starting in comic books. She was one of the rare women at the beginning. Mm-hmm. Didn't she also write text-only pieces in some comic books?
Yeah.
What were they?
Yeah, she would, like historical text pieces. A lot of early comic books had one-page text pieces mm-hmm. just to prove to the world that they were, a little more sophisticated than you would expect. So she wrote about Catherine the Great in one of her text pieces, little historical mini biographies is what she contributed.
And what about some of the other women who worked in the comics? Audrey Blum, Olive Bailey didn't stay long because it was a male world?
There were different reasons for each one. Audrey Bloom got married and then moved out of the city and became a housewife, basically. But she was one of the first writers. She was Jewish, and she was a writer for the Will Eisner, Jerry Iger shop. And then she worked for Will Eisner, writing The Spirit for him when he went into World War II. And then she just left the business. She got married and left. And the same with Olive Bailey and some of the other ones.
Gladys Parker.
Quite a few women in the first volume, though. You've got, you know, Marie Severin.
Actually, only three in the first. And I got scolded. And I said, look, you know, it's not my doing. It was really a man's world. But I have three in the first. And there's about 10 in the new one, I think.
Another one is Gladys Parker.
Right.
Who created Mopsy.
That's right.
Beautiful.
Yeah. She actually, like, stayed in the business and continued drawing Mopsy into the 50s, I think, and 60s. She died fairly young.
Now, in some cases, there's even a family connection. John Romita and his son?
Yeah. Well, yeah, John Romita is actually a guy I got to meet when I spent a week up at Marvel when I was 13 years old in the early 70s. A sweet guy. And his son has become a star in that world of comic books as well in the last 2 years, John Romita Jr.
They've changed a lot. Are comic books now made with the idea that eventually they're going to be movies?
I'm sure that's the thinking now. I don't pay much attention to what's coming out as far as mainstream comics. I have particular favorite artists like Daniel Clowes and Chris Ware and people like that.
But they're doing graphic novels.
The indie comics, yeah, graphic novels and the indie comics. And that's the stuff I'm interested in these days.
Yeah, given that DC and Marvel are both owned by huge media corporations, and DC has in fact been moved out to California to be closer to the Time Warner Entertainment, that connection of movies is a stronger and stronger force.
My connection to DC is that Mad Magazine is owned by DC Comics now. So I occasionally do work for Mad still, so that's my one connection to that world.
When I was a kid, DC Comics was the home of the superheroes without personality, and Marvel was the home of the superheroes who were all neurotic.
Yeah, that's true. In the early 60s, when the Silver Age, they call it, is when the Marvel Comics exploded, and that's when my dad was up there, and I would collect that. By the time I was seven, I had stacks and stacks of those comics because my dad would bring them back every Friday from the office.
So, don't you have a documentary in the works?
Yeah, there's a film being made about me called Vermeer of the Borscht Belt. The director is Kevin Dougherty. It's the filming commences next year, and it's about my life and my artwork.
And you could see some of that artwork in Drew Friedman's latest book, which is called More Heroes of the Comics, 100 New Portraits of the Legends of Comic Books. And he has been here to talk about it, which the book is published, by the way, by Fantagraphics Comics. Thank you, Drew, and thank you, Karen Green, Columbia University's first curator for comics and cartoons.
Thanks, Lynn.
Thank you very much.